Jesus tells two stories, both about what happens when something is lost. What lengths do we go to find something that is missing in our lives? What do we do when we find it? So if we read the stories today, at first glance, it might seem like an overreaction. A shepherd loses a sheep. Doesn't that happen all the time? How hard can it be to retrieve one? So I'm guessing not many of you have a lot of context for shepherding. I don't either. We hear it in stories like these. But you probably remember the boy who cried wolf. The boy is a shepherd. He calls out, "Wolf, wolf," and all of the villagers come running to help till he does it a third time when the wolf really comes, and you know what happens. Why does the boy cry wolf? He does it because shepherding is boring. There's not a lot to do when you're watching sheep. You are watching sheep. And if that's all you're doing, how hard is it for one to get lost? So much for the first story. So the second story, a woman loses a coin. We've all been there. But even if there's a debate over how much each one of these coins is worth, the fact of having nine more should soften the blow. So for either of these things, is it worth calling the neighbors over to celebrate? I found my sheep. I had 100. I lost one, and it's back. Or I found one of 10 coins. I think your neighbors would tell you, I have something else to do. I'd rather go home. It's hardly even worth a Facebook post. I think that's a clue to us that there is more going on here. So what would you have to find to prompt a reaction like this? Jesus tells a parable, two parables, about what happens when something is lost. So what is he actually talking about finding here? As luck would have it, I've got a couple of guesses. You're looking at your watch thinking, yes, I gathered that. So writing in the Guardian newspaper a couple of years ago, Rutger Bregman excerpts his book about human nature. So he asks his reader to think about the classic story, The Lord of the Flies. So a group of boys, scions of the British upper classes, are stranded on a deserted island, and they resort to savagery without adult supervision. So Bregman reads this book, and he doesn't find it very plausible. And his opinion is validated when he discovers a similar story of six boys who were shipwrecked on an abandoned island near Tonga, where they stayed for over a year without devolving into major conflict. So the boys in the story had stolen a boat on a lark, and they had taken only a few bananas and coconuts and a gas stove with them. They didn't think they were going to be gone for very long. When a storm drove them ashore onto a deserted island, they spent months foraging food, discovering wild chickens or chickens that had gone wild, and seabird eggs and grapes. And one boy, the leader named Stephen, broke his leg, and the others set the bone with a splint of palm fronds and bamboo. So the doctor who examined the boys after they were rescued were amazed how well the leg had healed and what good physical condition they were all in. So the rescue of the boys is a remarkable story, too. Another Australian runaway, a man named Peter Warner, a fishing boat captain, was near a desolate-looking island when he saw smoke. And when he looked closer, he saw what looked like people jumping into the water from a high cliff. And the first boy made it to the boat. He said, "My name is Stephen. There are six of us. We reckon we've been here for 15 months. Bregman picks up the story, writing, "The boys once aboard claimed they were students at a boarding school in Nuku'alofa, the Tongan capital. Sick of school meals, they had decided to take a fishing boat out one day, only to get caught in a storm." Likely story, Peter thought. Using his two-way radio, he called Nuku'alofa. "I've got six kids here," he told the operator. "Stand by," came the response. 20 minutes ticked by. As Peter tells this part of the story, he gets a little misty-eyed. Finally, a very tearful operator came onto the radio. He said, "You found them. These boys have been given up for dead. Funerals have been held. If it's them, this is a miracle." So they made it home. And the entire Tongan island of Haafewa welcomed them in celebration. Even the king of Tonga was there. "Rejoice with me, I have found what was lost." It's a different story. Six little boys separated and then reunited with their families. It sounds a little different from one missing sheep. I think when Jesus is talking about sheep, he's talking about something more. When we read a story like this and Jesus begins, "Which of you," we think he's talking about us. That we're the shepherd, but which one of us, if we hadn't lost something, wouldn't go out to find it? The answer, of course, is almost no one. Because in Jesus' audience, few people are going to have 100 sheep. That's a pretty rich person. And if one of those sheep wanders from the crowd, from the herd, who's going to go into the wilderness to look for it? So first of all, you have to notice that the sheep is missing. You have to decide, that looks like only 99 sheep. And then what happens when you leave the other 99? You've already lost one. Now you've got shepherdless sheep in the wilderness. I don't think anything good is going to happen. But for some reason, the missing sheep is precious enough that the shepherd is going to go looking. I don't think Jesus is talking about sheep. And I don't think we're the shepherd in this story either. So maybe we're like a woman who loses a coin. You've probably lost a coin before, or your car keys, or your phone, or the remote control. I spend half of my life looking for the remote control. The woman loses a coin of all things and tears the house apart until she finds it. We don't know how much the coin is worth, but I think that seems like an overreaction too. It reminds me of another story. A recent New Yorker article, D.T. Max tells the story of James Howells. Howells has become a local celebrity in his Welsh town for losing one of the largest fortunes anyone could ever hope to acquire. So ironically, the story begins with a cleaning. Howells is a computer engineer, and one day he decided to clean out his home office in advance of a trip he was taking. He thought, I don't want to deal with this when I get back. So during the tidying, he found a thumb drive, and he'd forgotten what was on it, and so he threw it aside without thinking much of it. You know, thumb drive is just an external drive you plug into your computer to save things. And the next morning, his girlfriend took the trash to the dump. But Howells couldn't get over this feeling that something had gone wrong. He was in a bad mood his whole trip, and when he got back a week later, he read a story in the newspaper about someone in Norway putting a down payment on a house from his savings in Bitcoin. And then he remembered. The thumb drive he had thrown away contained the password to access his Bitcoin account. And rather than using this part of the sermon to describe what cryptocurrency is to you, which I don't actually understand, just think of it as the sort of investment where it's good to get in on the ground floor. So for frame of reference, Howells was one of the world's earliest miners of Bitcoin. He owned thousands of them. He was the equivalent of buying Apple stock in 1979 or Coca-Cola stock in 1920. So by the time he threw away his thumb drive in 2013, his Bitcoin account was worth $1.3 million. It's a pretty substantial amount, obviously worth looking for, but then the value only went up. And so by the time it reached $6 million, he confessed to his girlfriend. His girlfriend later left him. So he went to the city dump, which showed him an immense pile of garbage. He lost heart until the sanitation engineer explained to him that the pile was arranged systematically, which meant that with the city's permission, Howells should be able to locate and excavate that thumb drive from his garbage. So he began a multi-year legal fight with the city, and despite multiple petitions, consultants, and engineering studies, including a consult with a NASA-affiliated agency about retrieving data from damaged hardware, Howells has yet to gain permission to excavate. He thinks the city is hiding something in the dump. So he can't tear through the trash and find what he is missing, which as of November was worth $550 million. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one of them, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? It may not be the most appropriate reaction for a missing penny, although maybe it is. But maybe you can imagine tearing apart your life for something you hold much higher value. That's what Jesus is describing. He's not talking about sheep or about coins. He's talking about you. You are of inestimable value to God. And there is nothing that God has not done or will not do, that Jesus has not done or will not do, to rescue you, wherever you may be. And the occasions for this story are like last week, maybe at a dinner party. There's no invitation list this time. There are a long line of undesirables who are looking for something. Tax collectors and prostitutes, and they've seemed to have found this something in Jesus. So Luke has it now, all the tax collectors and sinners coming near to listen to him. The sinners are there, so the Pharisees are there too, the religious leaders. And since their faith demands personal efforts at holiness, Jesus associating with tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes, the worst of the worst, colors their perception of Jesus. This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them. So welcoming is one thing. Maybe he's just being polite. But eating with them, bringing them into fellowship, into the household of God, treating them as equals, that's beyond the pale for people who think your personal holiness is the most important thing that you have. And so this comment occasions the two stories we read today. And there's actually a third story that goes with them. You probably know it fairly well. It's the story of the prodigal son. We'll get to it in a couple of weeks. Amy Jill Levine, the New Testament scholar at Vanderbilt University, says we might think of these three stories together as all about something lost, a lost sheep, lost coin, and a lost son. Prodigal was coined by St. Jerome, the early translator. And I won't get into depth on that story today, but you probably remember the gist of it. The younger son squanders a family inheritance. Something is lost. And coming home disgraced, he is welcomed by his father to the disapproval of his elder brother. You can see a similar dynamic at work in this dinner party, what with the disapproving Pharisees and the undesirable guests. But Jesus doesn't call names and he doesn't directly attack the Pharisees. He tells the story. And it's about us. Which of you, he wonders. And like I said, the answer to which of us goes out into the wilderness to find one missing animal, which one of us tears apart a house for one coin, the answer is not one of us. No one does this for something they perceive to be of little value. No one calls the neighbors over after the fact to celebrate. Jesus isn't talking about a sheep or a coin. He's talking about us. He's not just talking about us either. He's talking about the way we appear in the eyes of God. That we're worth seeking out, becoming flesh for, suffering for, and dying for, rising for. We might not think that highly of the people around us. We might not think that highly of ourselves. But God does. And maybe God values different things. We like our goodness and our competence, our pharisaical side. We're less likely to appreciate the parts of ourselves we try to hide, or we'd rather not see, our vulnerabilities or our failures or our flaws. We go to great lengths to hide them sometimes. And God seeks them out and redeems them. And it doesn't matter who we are, how holy or how imperfect, whether we are sinners or saints, we are both. And so when we wander away from God or the faith, hoping to find our own way, it's easy to lose sight of what we're looking for. We might realize that our failures and disappointments follow us into the wilderness too. And so in trying to lose them of those parts of ourselves we'd rather hide, we find ourselves lost. The only thing that can rescue us then is God. And that's just where God shows up. An irrational shepherd tearing through the wilderness, or an energetic woman sweeping her house. You go to great lengths to hide sometimes. God goes to greater lengths to find you. And there is no length that God will not go to rescue you from your failure, your disappointment, your fear, or your sin. So this story is about you, but not the way that you think. When it comes to God, we're not the ones who do the looking, we're the ones who are found. Just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. A couple of weeks ago at the church door, following a sermon I gave on Jesus calling his disciples to carry a cross, one of you wisely said to me, "I'd like to hear you give a sermon on the joys of discipleship sometime." It's a fair point. It's not always easy. That's the point of carrying a cross. But joy is rarely found in easy things. Maybe it's only found in accomplishing hard ones, or maybe it's only found in grace-filled gifts that we don't deserve. So what happens when God finds us? When you realize in your life that there is nothing else you need to do to be loved or worthy or saved, Jesus says, "Rejoice with me." It's the only imperative in the story. It's the only thing you need to do in response to what God has done. Rejoice. So what is it we do when we read stories like this every week and sing songs and pray? We rejoice. When we study and learn in greater depth what it means to commit to this kind of life, we rejoice. And when we have the opportunity to share with others something that we have received from our bank accounts or in our collective action and mission, we rejoice. And sometimes it may feel like there's not a lot of room for that in your life right now, whether it's the past 2 years or whether it's how long the prayer list has gotten. It may not feel like the time for rejoicing in your life. Weeping may stay for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Nothing you have been through changes the fact that no matter how far you may feel from God right now, how far you feel from good news, God is still pursuing you, going to irrational lengths so that you can recognize the inestimable value of your life. And the only demand offered to you is rejoice. Celebrate. Just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Amen.